Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, September the 8th, 1995. In the fireside room this morning, we have Ed Schrader, and he will be speaking on why Jesus and not just Buddha for living in a world of suffering. Let's listen in on Ed Schrader.
Today's session is the fourth of a series we've been doing this week on the question, why Jesus? I mean, why is Jesus necessary? Especially in today's world when other world religions already are present in the United States with their Buddhists and Muslims, Hindus, the three main world religions outside of the Christian framework, and when many a secular proponent in our society, or sometimes even just kind of a subliminal motif of the Western world, is not only don't you need Jesus, you probably don't even need God, or at least you need God only in cases of emergency, or maybe God at least for Sundays. But why Jesus? Why Jesus at all? And especially so if, as is happening, I've heard to many of you, or many of the people here, and to me too, that you have personal friends or work together with people who are Muslims, or Buddhists, or Hindus. And they seem to be fantastically nice people, you know, moral, ethical, concerned about, you know, they look like they could be Jesus' disciples in the image we have of that, but they aren't. They said, you know, Jesus is a nice guy, but that's not for me. So, the first session, back on Monday, we looked at the New Testament itself and how New Testament writers answered that question. Because in principle, that's what happened when the Christian messengers went out to their world. They met two basic communities of people, each who had a religion going for them, and they thought that was good enough. One was Judaism, from which most all the Christians initially came, and the other was the religion of the Greek Hellenistic world surrounding the Mediterranean Sea, into which the Christian apostles and missionaries went after they sort of got out of Palestine and moved on out and around. We just focused on one answer. We didn't focus. We picked up one answer that Paul makes in the first sermon he ever preached when he was out on the mission route, and that was on his first missionary journey, recorded in Acts 13, where at a Jewish synagogue, because Paul, as Jew, always first went to the Jewish communities that were sprinkled all around the Mediterranean basin, even way over as far as Spain. He first started with those folks, where he was technically at home, although sometimes before long he got run out, and said, you know, I'm a Jew just like you are. I revere the Hebrew, the scriptures, just like you do. But something happened back there in Jerusalem not too long ago that I want to tell you about. And one of the things he says that in that sermon to these Jews in Antioch of Pisidia, which means Antioch on the Asia Minor Peninsula, not Antioch back over there near Syria, in Syria. He says, and from this Jesus, we can be set free from all sorts of things that even Moses and the law could not set us free. So, you know, as good as Moses was, the law of God, there are things about the law of God that still leave us incarcerated. And this Jesus springs us loose from that as well. So that's why it was good and new, and therefore, if you will, good news. It was new in that here was a way to even be forgiven or be liberated from things that you couldn't get in the old one. And it sure was good to have that additional liberation and freedom and forgiveness that couldn't come from there. Okay, next day we looked at therapy, and that dragged out to two sessions, which we carried on then yesterday. Why Jesus, when contemporary psychiatric therapy and counseling offers so much help for so many people. And lots of Christians testified to that, and Christians that were in our group did too that day and yesterday. And so today now we're moving to something that may be a little more abstract, a little farther away from many of us, maybe not. And that is one of the major world religions. I could have taken Islam or Hinduism. Tomorrow I'm going to try to look, not tomorrow, this afternoon. The fifth session is this afternoon. Whew, I better hurry up. The fifth session is publicized on the board. But I decided to take Buddhism, and to get us into it right away, why don't we just begin with the half sheet you've got, and here, why don't you start reading?
Session 4. Why Jesus and not the Buddha for living at peace in a world of suffering? A clue comes from Peter's first epistle. The short story of Buddhism and its founder, Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha.
I'll give that short history as soon as you finish reading these few lines.
The word Buddha equals the enlightened one. It is a title like the word Christ, which equals the Messiah.
So it's not a personal name, like the word Christ. Christ wasn't Jesus' middle name, but he was Jesus the Christ. And Christos is just the Greek translation of the word Mashiach, which means the one who had been anointed, the one who had oil poured on him.
There are many denominations in Buddhism, as there are in the Christian family. The two chief branches are Theravada, Hinayana, those are the same. And the
those are synonyms.
Buddhism. The best known in the States is Zen Buddhism, which is a Japanese denomination.
At least I think that's accurate to say that Zen Buddhism has been most well known in the U.S., and Zen is really, if you will, a denomination of Buddhism that comes via Japan. I should have asked before, now that I remember who the reader is, who has been in countries where Buddhism, outside of the U.S., where Buddhism is part of the religion of the land? Oh, my gosh, 1, 2, 3, 4. Well, let's just get a little testimonial, or at least a little description of where you were and what your experience or encounter with Buddhism was. Ms. Finn.
I'm just back from 2 years in Cambodia, and Cambodia is 90% Buddhism coming out of the Theravada Buddhism tradition. And also their Buddhism is very much stressed because during the time of Pol Pot, when so many intellectuals were killed, the monks were killed and the temples torn down. And so they're rebuilding, since 1980, their religious base.
And one more thing you told us at lunch about how Buddhism is not just a religion practiced by the people, like it is in, like Christianity may be in large places in the U.S., but Buddhism is really woven into the very fabric. Or what did you tell us the other day at supper?
Well, I think prior to the devastation of the Pol Pot time, Buddhism was central to the core of the community. The communities all revolved around the temples and the teachings and instructions and morality and all of that sort of thing for the society came out of schools, which were also based in temples grounds.
And the king always had to be a Buddhist. There was no question that the king wouldn't be a Buddhist because he was not technically a priest, but in some sense sort of the political high priest of the country.
Yeah, actually the king is a monk.
He is a monk.
In order to fulfill his duties to become a king.
Okay, see.
But anybody can be a monk in Cambodia.
Yeah. Anybody?
Yeah.
Even women?
They're nuns.
Yeah, okay.
But you can become a monk for a day and then stop being a monk again.
Uh-huh, and then live a normal life.
Yeah.
See, it's got a lot to offer, folks. Margaret, what was your Buddhist encounter?
Very slight. I spent a little while in Japan long ago, and I lived in Hawaii, where there were many Buddhists and Buddhist temples. But very minor. These people have much more to say.
Okay. I don't know who these people are. Would you tell us again?
I'm Carol O'Dean, and I'm going to be here next week on the faculty.
Okay.
We've been to Japan and Taiwan. Walt's been to other countries, but those are the basic ones that I've been to. And I had an interesting experience in Japan. My guide, a young woman architect, was taking me to a number of these temples. And I was a little confused as to whether I was going into the Buddhist temple or one of Shintoism, and asked her about the worship in these. And she said, "Oh, well, most of us are both. You know, we worship one for certain occasions and others for other occasions." Mm-hmm. So she had been married in a Shinto temple, but they had their funerals in the Buddhist temple. Well, that was perfect. And really interesting with my background.
Dan?
Pardon?
Pardon?
Walt, yeah.
As Carol said, I've been to South Korea three times and then some of these other countries and where these Buddhas are. I've been so busy working with the people on agricultural things that I've only seen the shrines and been present at homes and this and that, so I really don't have, like, just about anything you tell me will be new.
Were you ever in Seoul when it was Buddha's birthday?
Not that I know of.
Marie and I were there on one occasion. We've been to Korea a few times, too. And that was the most incredible, you know, evening parade.
Yeah.
I forget how many miles long it was. It
lasted for hours.
Yeah.
And even in some cases, I don't know if there were any officially Christian groups marching. Big, you know, big groups of 50 or 100 or 200, 300 people, you know, all in... What's the Korean word for the women's fancy dress? Not kimono, but whatever.
Hanbok.
Whatever. And in some cases, these people were singing Christian songs. Christian melodies. They were singing in a Korean language, but Onward Christian Soldiers was one of the melodies we heard. And I think I asked them, are those Christians? And they said, no, that's just sort of part of this... this sort of loose polytheism that you mentioned, that folks can say, well, we can take some of that, and...
Well, the other one that, when we were in Taiwan, specifically was there to interact with the director of the Asian Food Research Development Center, and he took us on Sunday to this park where we had this huge Buddha, remember? But I thought he didn't spend very long trying to explain religious things, because he just told us this was part of the culture and so on and so forth. But still, it's imprinted in my mind.
Okay. You folks?
No.
First off, tell us who you are, huh? I'm Ed, and that's Marie. That's this couple.
And I'm Char Westrom.
And my name is Rod Westrom. I'm a school teacher from Minneapolis.
Char and Rod. Are you also part of the staff already, or next
we've
week?
We've only been here a few days, and we're leaving today.
Well, what's your shtick for next week?
Art and spirituality. Uh-huh. We'll start with the early female goddesses, fertility goddesses.
So he's in agriculture, and you're in fertility. I guess that's
right.
They've got me under ethics out on the board here. No, but...
what are you supposed to be doing?
Well, I know what I'll be talking about.
Tell us what you're going to do, regardless of what they call it.
History of food and where do these good things come from and what are problems today. That's sort of just the whole deal.
Okay. All right. I'll try to fill in a little just on that first line. And this is super sketchy, and it may well be that many of you may know at least that much. About in the 6th century B.C., that's the same time on the biblical line as Isaiah and Jeremiah, the time when Israel is taking, not Israel, but the southern kingdom, Judah, goes into Babylonian captivity, the 500s B.C. Siddhartha Gautama, he wasn't called the Buddha, he wasn't a king, he got that title after his great enlightenment at age 29, was born a prince in a king royal family right near the Nepalese-Indian border. Way up north there, bumping pretty soon the Himalayas. And lived, as princes do, you know, with everybody taking care of him. And one day, one of his teacher guides was going with him out into the city, and he saw four things that allegedly he had never seen before. One of them was an old, old man. Now, much of this is hard to document, you know, that it was really part of his autobiography, but this is what the tradition now says. And he was shocked by what he then saw would be the end of, would be the last days of his life, this frightfully old man. Then he saw a very sick man. And that was another jolt, that it isn't just that you get old, but people get sick and suffer long before they get old. And then allegedly for the first time he saw a human corpse that was being carried out to the edge of the river to be burned in the final, you know, funeral sacrifices. And on that same trip, he saw then a fourth man, and this was an ascetic, a monk. And that was the Hindu world, Hinduism. And all of these apparently then combined to jolt him into the realization that there is suffering and death in the world, you know, and it's not all just like we've got it in the palace. Before, now I've forgotten how long down the line he went, he was, I think, already parent arranged marriage at a very early age. And it was just about the time then that the first son was born he had come to the conviction that he had to leave this life of opulence and no pain and everything peachy keen and see if he could get enlightenment, understand what the world was really about, especially the suffering component in the world. And for the first, I think, about 6 years, he took the example of that fourth man he saw, a fiercely dedicated ascetic. And he, you know, punished his body, went without food, you know, did without everything until he got very sick himself and almost died. But he did that for 6 years and finally came to the conclusion that kind of radical way to sort of divest yourself of what riches and wealth and enjoyment and overconsumption does to you, that ain't the way to go. And obviously the way of wealth and riches and consumption like he'd had, that wasn't the way to go either. And he then moved toward what's called the middle way. So Buddhism often calls itself the middle way. And that way then is not to somehow get purged and cleaned by radical asceticism and sort of self-torture, and obviously not by the other way where you just wallow in it. But the way of meditation and reflection so that you get insight into both of those bad options. And one day at, I've forgotten what age, 29 or 30, and he never went back, not until he got enlightened did he ever go back home and see his wife and son again. In fact, he left while they were sleeping. They didn't know where he went. They didn't know that he was leaving. That was, in effect, part of his, you know, divestiture, not even to have any tearful and warm embracing farewells, but just to say thanks, but no thanks. Now, not that that's evil, but that life is not for me. And one day, sitting under a tree that originally had a different name, but it's now called the Bodhi, B-O-D-H-I tree, which is the Sanskrit word for to be enlightened, in meditating many hours and wrestling with evil Hindu, wicked, demonic goddess, not goddess, god, who tried to tempt him back into all the goodies of the life that he had left back at the palace. He renounced this demonic, this evil deity left, saying, I'm licked. And then a few more hours or maybe later to the day, he suddenly had the flash of enlightenment, and which means he became Buddha, the enlightened one. And in that enlightenment were four noble truths, which come in a minute on the page. The first one is that even if you live in the palace and have luxury, all of human life really is suffering. Suffering, and death is the last step then of that suffering. Noble truth number two was underlying all that suffering. Why there is so much suffering in the world is because people have desire. They covet. They want stuff that they don't have. And often that means that you got to take it from somebody else and then that person suffers. Or often you take the stuff that you really shouldn't have and it causes you suffering. Or the suffering is that now you want to hang on to it and you suffer on how you're going to hang on to all you got. So that desire or lust, although lust is not simply meant sexual desire, lust, desire, covetousness is at the center of, not the center, the root of why there is suffering in the world. And he stopped then his diagnosis, to use the language we've been using here a little bit, of sort of that human condition and said, therefore, the way to be healed from this is to get rid of desire, to somehow quench desire. And his third noble truth was, there is a way to escape that, and quenching desire is the way. And then his fourth noble truth was, what is the way to do that? And that was the Eightfold, called Path, I think so. Someplace here, I got that written down. I don't have that memorized. If the cross is often, you know, the visual symbol for Christianity, the visual symbol for Buddhism is a wheel with eight spokes. And those eight spokes represent that, you know, that's the way to go. You roll that wheel. And here are the, I think I got it scribbled down here, if I can find it, the eight things, the eight pieces of the path to finally destroy desire. And once desire is totally quenched, that is nirvana. The word nirvana means a space or place where there is no yen for anything, but everything is, you know, in equilibrium, everything is at peace, and you have no yen desire, lust for anything else, and it, you know, it's just, well, it's nirvana. The Eightfold Path, yeah, it's called Path. The Eightfold Path was to have the right way of viewing everything. Most of these things are, first of all, right. To have right thinking, right speaking, right actions, a right kind of way of life, we'd call it lifestyle today, I suppose, a right endeavor, that if you have any sort of motions in yourself as to where you'd like to go or what you'd like to move to, that that's the rightful way. And obviously, in this case, you should be seeking to move toward nirvana. Right mindfulness, I don't know how that's different from thought, but all of these, by the way, are Sanskrit words which are difficult to translate into any Western language, English as well. And the encyclopedia translator says that the fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh one was right mindfulness, and I'm not sure even what that would mean. And the last one was right concentration, the proper way to focus and concentrate on things so that, you know, you could divest and could let go and finally even could get this yen out of your heart, always to want something still.
Can you say it was thinking, speaking, or thinking after speaking?
I'll just tick off again. Right way of seeing, right way of thinking, right way of speaking, right way of acting, and right way of living, which apparently is different from acting. Rightful endeavor, or, you know, where you'd like to move to, right mindfulness, right kind of concentration of how you meditate and reflect on things. And before long, he developed a small little community of followers, and before long it grew and grew and grew and grew and grew. And by his death at age 80-something, he already had a humongous following in northern India and in Nepal, including his own King Papa, and I think his mother had died already, including his quote, former wife, who was technically still his wife, but he hadn't been home for years, and the son. And it became then, well, what it amounts to initially is that it's a reform movement within Hinduism. Now, if you want to think of it that way, you could say it was sort of like the Protestant Reformation within Catholicism. At least that's an analogy. And so some of the elements of Hinduism are in with and under it. But one of the important departures from Hinduism is a radical departure from the whole caste notion, which in Hinduism is part of the religion. You know, that some people are just born that way not so much by the deity's decision, but by their own karma, you know, as they come around for another reincarnation and another reincarnation. Wherever you and I are now, according to Hinduism, is caused by what we did in our previous incarnation. And if we got a good life, that's because our karma, maybe our payoff, is good for having been dead. And if we got a hell of a life, that's because we deserved it from what we did the last time around. Karma is a simple word for just you get what you got coming. I'm sure it's more complicated than that, but that's the mechanics of it. So he scrubbed caste altogether because that is the occasion for suffering, especially, you know, when you're on the lower ones. And the lower ones desire to be reborn in their next reincarnation at a higher caste, so it feeds desire, the caste, etc., etc., etc. So his whole way, just these four noble truths already resulted, you know, in consequences for classical Hinduism. Classical Hinduism also has got zillions of denominations, so there are a wide variety of them. And the Buddhism, Ms. Finn, I forget your first name.
Kate.
The Buddhism that Kate encountered in Southeast Asia is Theravada, supposedly still more classical Buddhism. The Buddhism that you encounter in Japan, Korea, and
Taiwan
is the other, is Mahayana, and has, in some cases, you and I as Westerners may be looking at that, we'd say, well, those look like two completely different religions, given all the component parts that are in there. Although there are many common denominators, based on three at least. One is that the Buddha himself is the central figure for enlightenment, and he is the model for how you too could become a Buddha, enlightened. Number two is the teaching about this Four Noble Truths and Eightfold Way. And the number three is the monastic community, the Sangha, I think that's its name in Sanskrit. Those three things are present, apparently, you know, I'm no expert, but apparently through all the different denominations of Buddhism all throughout the world. And of course, the big focus of Buddhism is what we call East and Southeast Asia, where roughly half of the people of the world live. China, India, and the Southeast.
I haven't thought of this before, but Hinduism has zillions of gods and goddesses too, but I don't see any mention of that, and I can't remember seeing any in the Buddhist temples.
Funny you should say that. Why don't we move on?
Oh.
the Roman numeral 2 is my patterning the Buddhist, I was going to call it theology, but there are these handouts. Some are on half page, but some are on whole page. Half page, just have them on front and back. Under Roman numeral 2, I've got the basic pattern, the Four Noble Truths, is, now before I go into that, I'm going to tell you what the rationale of this patterning is. In the previous three sessions we've had, where we've always been looking at biblical stuff in relation to whatever we're talking about as an alternative, possible good news, we've noticed that in the biblical, in the Bible, the diagnosis of people's malady, always, in every one of the books of the scriptures, really proceeds in three steps, deeper, deeper, deeper. It's like an x-ray. That first sort of just takes a picture a little bit below the skin, and then a deeper x-ray, and then finally the deepest of all. And the x-ray of problem, first of all, you know, I'm going to say diagnosis of illness, or, you know, what's wrong with the human race, is in actions on the surface, but everyone knows that people's actions are related to what's going on their inside, or as the Bible says, what's going on in the heart. Remember, Jesus' word, out of the heart proceeds, blah, 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 all these wicked things. And the Christian, in Christian rhetoric at least, we don't say, dear God, please give me help to do new actions, but create in me a new heart, O God, and put righteousness back there. But the Bible even goes one step deeper, and it says, whatever kind of heart we got is always related to what our de facto, what our actual God relationship is. And that might actually be different from what we say as an action in Sunday morning church, although it's not happy if that's the case. Okay, so we always looked at the diagnosis that way, and in the past Bible text we've done, we've said, now what is the good news at every level, you know, to bring good news to a sick and ill God relationship, and then good news to the heart, and even good news and to the life of actions and behaviors. And the biblical paradigm always says, first of all, for the deep one, you got to start off with Jesus the Christ. Or at least that he's at the center of the Christian good news. not just in terms of our behaviors and ethics, or even in terms of our heart, what we're fearing, loving, or trusting, but first of all, good news in getting us reconnected to God in a way that is good, happy, life-giving, and not destructive, deadly, imprisoning, or whatever. All right, as Maria has hinted in her question, Buddhism has no concern for what's below here. And to that extent, the whole phenomenon of God is not really an important piece of the Buddhist religion. So Margaret, would you just read Roman numeral 2, the diagnosis, two levels down, and then come up and over up here. So read these two things that have been a horseshoe pattern, down, over, up.
Is that this paragraph here?
Well, it says the basic pattern, yes.
There's no level? No? I'm sorry, right. So above that. Oh, that, I see. The basic pattern, Four Noble Truths, is level one diagnosis. A human life is an unending chain of suffering.
So that's the first noble truth. And then just go straight down to the next two lines.
Level two is suffering arises from selfish desire.
Okay, we talked about that already. It's two of the four noble truths. Now go over and start here at the bottom and read three and four. How at the level two already, Buddhism proposes healing.
Three is freedom from desire is possible. Nirvana is the name of such a state. And four is the Eightfold Path, the way to freedom, tough self-discipline.
Because what you need to finally kill is any desire of any sort, even want to be different, or to want to be in a different place, let alone no sexual desire, hunger desire, all of that. And then, come on up. One, Margaret, to where the level one healing?
When level two is healed, level one is two.
Because if you've got no more desire, then you are not inflicting suffering on anybody, nor are you receiving suffering from anybody, or even from the things that other people say hurt. You know, I'm so hungry it hurts. But a Buddhist who has attained enlightenment, it is not hurt by his starvation. At least that's because he is so detached. Detachment is sort of the key word. And not just to be detached from things, but even to be detached inside, that you even have no yen to be attached to anything. Okay, Marie, would you read the next one? This is at least a little of my commentary, not critique yet, but just observation, and that's what you, Marie, picked up.
There is no level three God problem. Buddhism has no underlying God reality in the core system. Many of the denominations have added divine figures to their specific form of Buddhism. But even in them, there is no parallel to the deep human problem illustrated in Genesis 3, namely humans being called to account before God and evaluated and sentenced as in a courtroom.
I just picked the classic episode in Genesis chapter 3, after Adam and Eve have done the forbidden thing, and already their conscience is operational, even before God appears back in the garden. And the writer says, and as soon as they did this, zap, they were filled with shame. Interesting enough, not guilt, but shame. I call that to your attention just because shame is the key word of a key word in 1 Peter's epistle, which we're going to look at here in just a minute. They are filled with shame, and you know, it's fig leaves in front and run into the bush and hide. Or at least Western artists have said it's fig leaves in the front and then run to the bush and hide. And then God appears later on that afternoon, you know, it's probably about time for tea or something, and he says, Adam, where are you? And then they shout out from the bush, you know, we're here, and God drags them out. And then what happens is really a courtroom scene. You know, God's the judge. He says, you blew it. Now, what do you have to say for yourself? You know, here's the accused now defending. And interesting enough, the male accused, what does he do? He said, the woman you gave me. Well, first, yeah, the woman tempted me, but it's not accidental. that God already gets pulled in Adam's first statement. The woman you gave me tempted me, and of course I did eat. So you know who eventually is going to be accused of having been the fault of it all. You don't see that right away, but then God says, okay, I'll go talk to Mrs. Adam, to Eve. And so he says, okay, Eve, he says, you're the fault. Why'd you do that? You know, give an account for yourself. And she says, wasn't me, the serpent. And now you have to imagine a parenthesis there. The serpent, and you know who created all the animals, closed. The serpent deceived me, beguiled me. So the deepest, you might say, wickedness of Adam and Eve is not only that they don't take responsibility for what they did, and not only do they blame somebody else, but finally they blame God. Mm-hmm. So it's your fault, not my fault. And that's an interesting switcheroo, because as soon as human beings blame God, who is in the dock to defend him, herself, and who is in the bench deciding the case? You know, it's a complete switcheroo. Suddenly God is in the dock as the one accused, and the human beings are the judges who are making the charge and are evaluating the case. Luther said that's the deepest insight for what original sin is. Original sin is not just some gosh awful, terrible sin, like, oh, disobeying God's commandment, but it's even worse than that. This word original sin, as illustrated in Genesis chapter 3, is when human sinners reject God's own critique of them and instead switch it around and say, God, we're going to critique you. That's the height of, you know, of hubris, of pride, of real self-centered self-elevation.
Boy, and you hear that all the time, don't you? Why did God make me this way? Why did God make people so and such? Why doesn't God do so and so and improve this world?
Shh. Let's not get too relevant here. Okay. Well, any other discussion or comments or thoughts on just this first part? This is my presentation, and to be sure, it's simplified. But I think this is the core blueprint, and all the denominational variations. When push comes to shove, you can push them. I mean, they will say, "Yeah, that's what the Buddha said." And all of us want to be loyal to him, even though we've got, you know, a wide variety of variations now in the various, what I call, denominations of Buddhism. Well, my caption way at the top said, why Jesus and not just the Buddha, as a way to live finally in peace in a world of suffering. And the peace that the Buddha gives is that there's no more conflict if nobody's desiring something. You know, why is there war in Bosnia? You know, the Serbs want still a couple chunks that look like it's under the Bosnian Muslims, and so-and-so wants this, and so-and-so wants that. Or even in Rwanda, even if it's not a fight about territory, the Tutsi want revenge over the Hutus, and people want something, and they'll kill for it. Or sometimes even they want something, they'll be willing to get killed for it. So this would really be peace if it would become the way of the whole world. At least that's the plausible proposal. And I've already hinted what my suggestion is, that the biblical good news says, you know, as good as that is, Gautama, it's not good enough, because it leaves untouched another deep root of the problem underlying human desire, which leads into human suffering.
This is maybe naive to ask this, but in that Buddhism, by not having the lower level there of God, and then...
I'll just put numbers on one, two,
okay,
three. Just
not having the three, isn't there almost an implication, not an implication, but a... that there is a God out there, that if you can, just like, you can't have, if you do this job right, you don't have any desires and all that, by golly, things are going to go on anyhow. And so therefore, there must be a God, or there must be something that keeps this thing going.
Okay, what is the thing, what is the power that...
But we aren't going to try and describe that.
Don't give up too quickly. The Buddhist, I mean, and Hindu has a
a name for a power or energy that keeps it going. And that's this. And the way karma keeps on going is reincarnation. You know, you come around again and again and again. Now, this thing isn't called God, but this surely is a power. There is this power in the universe that pays people off for what they got coming. Christians say that's God's power. You know, God is the one who said the wages of sin is death. Or if you do good, you get rewarded. And if you do evil, you get punished. Christians say the subject, grammatical subject of that operation is the God who created the world. But Buddhism and Hinduism, from which Buddhism came, says, not really. Hinduism has a zillion gods, but they don't have this supreme god who runs the whole show. And so karma is sort of the energy, the power, the nuclear generator, and reincarnation is the assembly line on how that power works itself out in world history. And
so even they realized there is something more than just desire that's underneath it, but they didn't want to call it.
No, this doesn't affect this.
Oh.
This is just the dynamics of human existence. And the consequences are,
Yes, but.
The language is the circle of reincarnation. That you come around again, and again, and again, and again. And nirvana, then, is not only to have no more desire. Here, let's just put, what was his name, Siddhartha Gautama in here. When he broke through to this enlightenment, and if he stayed there, he was rescued from this. He was out of it. No more reincarnation for him. Because that's the way he then escaped both this damnable cycle of always having to come back again, and also the power of karma. Because, karma and reincarnation, that's all just really one ball of wax. And so full salvation is to escape all that, to finally get out of it, and to be then in this. It's hard for us Westerners especially, I don't even know if Easterners, how they image that, but to image this disconnected from everything, and having no yens about anything. I think biblical theology would say that's not human existence at all anymore. Because, we are bodily beings. God made us that way. He didn't curse us with bodies that get hungry and thirsty and tired and drives for sex and affection and for warmth when it's cold and all that stuff. Christians say, hey, that's a gift of God. That's not a curse. And the Buddhist, although they wouldn't use the language of curse or blessedness, the Buddhist perspective is, having a body at all makes it tough right from the word go, because the body has desires, and the desires want to be fulfilled.
Well,
and in order to be fulfilled, you got to get out there and grab something, huh?
Is nirvana their heaven then, even if it's on earth?
Well, it's not. Well, that would be the equivalent, but it's not.
It's a place. Yeah.
It's not a place.
No.
And there's no activity there. There are no angels singing and praising the Lord. It's just absolute oneness with nothing, actually with nothing moving. No desires, no energy, no action, but complete rest. Complete, and that's what the word peace would mean there. Nothing to disturb, perfect equilibrium for every one of us who has somehow broken through to that. And then that of course lasts forever. Well, you're talking to someone who is no expert at all in this, and maybe I am a little more expert in the Bible stuff. Why don't we at least flip the page over if you have half a page? If you got a full page, it's just the bottom. Marie, you read the last piece on the Buddhist thing. Would you just, on a clue from 1 Peter, would you just take us down these 1, 2, 3s.
Okay.
And the 1, 2, 3s of 1 Peter are the language and image words that the first epistle of St. Peter uses for these three levels of diagnosis. And it's not just that he puts in a third one, but he's got his own way of diagnosing it. And I picked that because the subject for 1 Peter is suffering. Christians who are suffering, it's Christians,
But the theme is their suffering and how they cope with it. And so that at least is close to the Buddhist agenda.
Okay. The diagnosis, number one, Christians in exile, surprised, despairing, even ashamed about suffering trials, including the fiery ordeal.
Okay, Peter doesn't only say you folks are suffering, but he says your own reaction to your suffering is in a sense more suffering. You know, despair, depression, anxiety, even shame about that we're catching flack and catching flack and catching flack.
I think that what you said right there is critical to the Buddhist concept of suffering. I think that Buddhists acknowledge that they're suffering and that you're going to go through life and have all of these experiences, and how you take them on is going to determine whether you suffer or not. Mm-hmm. And what the whole Buddhist Eightfold Path is trying to do is to have you go through life experiencing the same things that everybody else experiences, but then not reacting the same way.
You cope differently.
You cope differently, yeah. Not bringing more suffering onto yourself by saying, I'm suffering, but by going through the Eightfold Path, you go through these same experiences.
You still suffer, you still have normal humans, but you are detached.
You have normal experiences, but the way you experience them and process them and take them in and let them out again is not the same way as suffering, so that you become free from what suffering that they can be.
What everybody else's suffering is.
Yeah. So I guess I would have a little bit of a different view of what classical Buddhism says about the state of nirvana, which is not that you're just that there's a still plane of equilibrium. I mean, you're still very much in the world, going through all of the same things that the rest of the people do. Your body's going to get old and sick and die, just like everybody else's. But how you meet that and greet that using the Eightfold Path will be very different.
Well, what's the character, and I'm asking you because I'm ignorant, what's the nature of nirvana after one's final demise?
I would say that classical Buddhism and this karma and circle of reincarnation and as to the issue of God, from the readings that I have done, says that what Buddha said was, it's immaterial. Don't ask me questions about whether there's God or karma. It's not the point. The point is, if you follow the Eightfold Path, you will reach the state of blessed peace or nirvana. And therefore, it's not a relevant question whether there's God or karma, or another going to be another life. Because if you do this, you will reach a state where there will be no more suffering for you, ever. Mm-hmm. In this life, next life, or whatever life. So I think that he just said it's just not a material question when we start talking about how to go through life with compassion and non-suffering.
Okay, good. That's helpful
Paul
for me.
Paul kind of achieved that level when he said that he's learned to be abused and so bad. And all things to give thanks. I mean, he's kind of touching on.
He is. I think so.
Whatever.
But for today, Margaret, I said, I'm not going to go to St. Paul, I'm going to go to St. Peter, who comes to the same conclusion, I think, so let's just track it through and see what we got. Would you continue? First level is, you know, the experience of suffering and dissatisfaction, surprise, despair, even shame about suffering, fiery ordeals. This is Peter's, even when I don't put it in quotation marks, most all of these terms are Peter's own words, his technical terms for describing it. Number two.
Faithless. Evaluating suffering as the world does, forfeiting their new birth, deserting, even rejecting the stone that is Christ they once believed, moving back into the darkness out of which God had called them, going astray like sheep.
So here's about a half a dozen of Peter's own image metaphors of what's going on the inside of these Christians when their response to suffering is like that, that they want to escape it, or they say, why us? Or even they say we're ashamed, and those are Peter's own words about being shamed by your suffering. Especially, he says, I didn't put this in the little outline, but Peter says there are two kinds of suffering. One is suffering you deserve because you were a criminal, you did wrong, you know, and you got your behind whacked. The other is the kind of suffering you Christians have because you are Christ's people. And folks say, oh, you're one of those Jesus freaks. You know, we don't like Jesus freaks here. You know, and then you suffer from that. And he's got two different things to say about the two kinds of suffering. He says, obviously, if you suffer just because you're a common crook, well, then you got it coming. And the good news for you would be to repent and, you know, trust Christ again, get your sins forgiven, and get back on track. But for the Christians who despair or are ashamed of the suffering that they get precisely because they're Christ men or women, that's what he's then diagnosing down here. He says, if you somehow say, since I suffer, I shouldn't deserve it or whatever, then that suggests in the heart the Christ connection is getting frazzled. Okay, and then the deepest, when the Christ connection is frazzled, what happens at the number three level?
Into that number, trusting, right? Trusting, returning to this good, to this shepherd.
No, we keep going down. Oh, we only came down one and two. We don't want to hit the pit, diagnosis does.
The relationship to God underlying it all, perishing will be put to shame. Flesh, grass, wither under God's own final analysis, stumble and fall.
These are Peter's own words for what I've got in the box number three of the diagnosis, that the God relationship is really being shattered and is falling apart. And you all Christians, you know, don't just need little minimal help, you know, how to react to suffering, or don't even need even deeper help, you know, how to get your hearts back on focus. But you need even deeper help. You need to get the God connection hooked up again, or at least hooked up in a way that looks healing rather than continually destructive. Because God, all of Genesis 3, is the God who judges. And for sinners who just stand before God on their own resources, like Adam and Eve did, you know, say, we can defend ourselves. For sinners who seek to do that, you know, here's Peter's terms for that kind of bad news situation. All right, now, let's move over to this column, but not start at the top. You know, what's the good news for the number one level? But start at the bottom, the number three level, which is what the good news always does, because it says, if we can't heal or bring healing to this deep one, you know, we might as well forget about the rest. Because this is like the root, you know, from which grows these kind of hearts, from which come these kind of fruits. I'm using one of Jesus' own images about a tree and the fruit it bears. And if you got a tree that's bearing bad fruit, he doesn't just say, well, knock off all the bad fruit and tie good fruits on there. But he says, no, the whole tree has to be renewed, starting from the roots. And so you got to get new roots for that tree, and from new roots will come a healthy plant, and from a healthy plant comes healthy fruit. So we start the good news discussion, at least at the bottom. And I guess we're coming around the back row. Would you please read number three, which is the parallel to diagnosis three.
Christ the Good Shepherd, also the sacrificial lamb, takes as his own our D3 diagnosis, swaps us his glory for our shame on the cross, swaps rejection for acceptance. 3:22-25.
Let's just pause it. I'll read those four verses in 1 Peter. You got it. Okay, good. Would you read that? Chapter 2, beginning at 22.
He committed no sin, no guile was found on his lips. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten. But he trusted to him who judges unjustly.
Unjustly?
Judges justly.
Yeah, he trusted God. Well, even while he was going through all this crap, you know, and not just crap, death. And now comes the very key words from St. Peter.
He himself bore our sins in his body on the tree, that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. By his wounds you have been healed. For you were straying like sheep, but had now returned to the shepherd and guardian of your souls.
So here Peter picks up what I call the deep number three diagnosis, their deadly relationship with God, and says the good news is, and you guys know that, but you know, at least these last couple of weeks, it sounds like you're slipping away from it again. And so I'll tell you again, the good news is not that Christ, that Jesus says, hey, you guys, don't stay over here, come over here by me. But first he says, tell you what, I'll come over there by you, and I will exchange, I use the word swap, I will swap the good news I have for the bad news you are in. I will swap my righteousness for your sinfulness, my wounds. I'll take your woundedness and give you my healing. These or I'll take your sins in my body on the tree so that you might be free from sin. I call that sweet swap, and that's a pet phrase with me now and with some others of our Crossings community around the world, even now in Ethiopia. It's a sort of slangy American English for Luther's phrase, fröhlicher Wechsel, this incredibly happy exchange. And Luther pulled it right out of St. Paul. He says, St. Paul, in many of his key places, when he's talking about why Christ crucified and risen is good news, he will use the image of exchange, that Christ takes our negatives, sin, liabilities, deficits, and gives us his righteousness, assets, whatever the other opposite word would be, credits. Example, 2 Corinthians 5. God was in Christ reconciling the world. You doubtless know it, probably even by heart. Not counting our trespasses against us, but, now listen, God made him, the Christ, to be sin like we are, so that in him we might get the righteousness that he has. You know, that's a sweet swap. I mean, it's a swap. He gets our sin, we get his righteousness. And Luther said, it sure is incredibly fruitful. You know, you want to sort of jump for joy. You know, nobody runs a business like that, to say, I'll take all your assets, give you all my credits, and we'll call that a good deal. But the radical nature of the gospel is God says, I'll make you that kind of deal. And of course, you're a fool not to accept it. Otherwise, you're stuck like Adam and Eve, having to, you know, make your own defense of your own righteousness in the divine courtroom. And if not today, then, you know, on the last day. Okay. Well, that's Peter's own language, and my last line there says, with its echoes of Isaiah 53, some of these phrases are almost straight out of that famous chapter, Isaiah 53, about the suffering servant. Surely he was wounded for our transgressions. He got bruised because of our iniquities. With his stripes, we get healed. And there's a few more like that, that sweet spot stuff. I'm sure that must have been the St. Paul's own source. For picking that theme up and applying it directly to Jesus on the cross, where Isaiah himself had sketched it out, saying, well, someday God's going to send such a one who's going to do that kind of incredible exchange. All right.
You should note that that is not a sweep swap.
Did I say sweep?
Yeah.
Where did I have... Oh, sorry. Yeah, it's supposed to be sweet to give sort of American English language to Luther's fröhlich, you know, incredibly joyful, wonderful, yum, yum. Okay, so this, you might say, I'll say radical in the literal meaning of the word. If this is the radical, radix means root of the problem, then here is radical gospel, you know, to heal that problem. And in effect, you might say, sort of to bring us back over here then, in the good news side. And from that radical healing, you know, comes a new shoot, something new growing, and from that then even comes new fruit, new things, new ways to live in the world. When? Suffering is the agenda we are confronting. So, move up one and read the number two things right there in the middle of that chunk.
Trusting, returning to this shepherd again. Living not by human desires, but by the will of God. Obedient to JC.
I hyphenated obedient because the word obedience in Latin has got the word audience in it. Audio means hear. And the Greek word for that, hypakoe, has the same meaning, that obedience is a kind of hearing. And obedience to Christ means not just doing what he said, but first of all, hearing what he says, listening to him. And of course, what he says to us, first of all, is, hey kids, I got sweet, swell, good news for you. And when we are audiencing that, you know, that brings changes in the heart. And when there are changes in the heart, that brings, you know, new kinds of ways to live in the world.
Through him, you have come to trust in God, new birth again and again, living hope in the face of anything.
Okay, there's a whole raft of Peter's terms that focus on, you know, the changes on the inside.